Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Side Hustles and Stuff podcast, episode 41. My name is Yuri, and I'm joined by Keishi.
Hey, Yuri, how are you today?
A little jeery. It's raining outside. I'm okay. How about you?
I'm good. Yeah, we were outside until an hour or two ago, and it was crazy. It was so windy. Almost felt like a typhoon.
Did you lose your hat?
Didn't lose my hat, but yeah.
Did your umbrella get like twisted inside out? You know, like when you watch weather reports or you read about them in the newspaper, they always manage to capture a picture of some poor person who's holding on to like a mangled inside out umbrella.
Yeah.
Did that happen?
No, not to mine, but the guy that was standing next to me on the at the traffic light.
It happened to me today. And the hat as well. Spring storms, April showers bring May flowers, except in March.
Sounds very poetic.
What is that? It's an idiom or it's a saying? Let me Google it.
Yeah.
April showers. It's a proverb. First recorded in 1886. But I guess here it's like April, March thunderstorms, March crazy wind as a result of global warming is probably the new updated proverb.
Perhaps.
But yeah. So what's on your desk today? What are you drinking?
What am I drinking? I'm drinking craft. What is it called? Craft tea with pieces of fruit inside.
Pieces of fruit inside. That's a new one.
Yeah, so I guess it's like an iced tea with so it says there's mango, strawberry, and orange pieces.
Where did you buy this?
At the Family Mart.
I'm gonna have to get some of that too. That sounds good. Pieces of fruit inside.
Yeah, it's really good. I think it's like the third or fourth time that I have it. I was always thinking I should get this for the podcast. Today's the time.
I'm a little jealous. Yeah, after last week's poor presentation.
So how about you? What are you drinking?
I got a combination of three. My much needed coffee. Nothing special. I've talked about this in the past ones, but coffee aside, I have something from Tohoku. Let's see. That's me reading Japanese. So I guess it's a mix of fruits.
Yeah.
Six fruits. There's a pear, cherry, another pear-looking thing, an apple, grape, and peach. Have you seen the logo? I mean, not the logo, the cover.
Let me look again. Yeah. I know that just, and I looked at it briefly. I also looked at it at the store briefly because I was considering getting it, actually. Yeah, I think the other pear-looking thing is nashi, Japanese pear. Okay. And I guess for those that don't know, Tohoku is the region of Japan. It is a northern region. That was the one that got hit by the tsunami.
Yeah.
10 years ago. And also by, I guess, a pretty big earthquake last night.
Yesterday, oh, yeah.
During the day.
Did you feel it?
No, we were outside, so I didn't feel it at all. But
actually, we were outside too, but like we were standing and looking at this map of this kind of like complex that we were looking, yeah, like inside with like shops and restaurants. And I noticed that the map was going back and forth, like it was shaking. I was like, for a second, I thought, like, you know, was there an earthquake?
Yeah.
And then it stopped. And then, so like we didn't pay it much mind, but later on, you know, I logged into Facebook and someone posted there was like a 7.1.
Yeah, it was a pretty big and long one.
I think if you're outside, you wouldn't feel it as much as opposed to being inside.
Yeah, I think it's pretty scary though, because it's been 10 years.
Yeah.
And this has been the second pretty large one over the last few weeks, right? There's been one more too long ago.
And these are, they call them aftershocks, right? Like aftershocks happen 10 years later. That's kind of the crazy part, that 10 years later, you can get hit by like a similar size, maybe slightly smaller earthquake that's just the result of an aftershock. Because my, like in the mind of someone that hasn't studied this or given it much thought, like an aftershock sounds like after it happens, maybe there'll be a few days where there'll be some more earthquakes due to the result of, but not like 10 years later.
Yeah, it's crazy. I guess we're talking geological scale here. I guess 10 years is nothing for Earth.
Yeah, that's true. Crazy. All right, so I mean, back to the drink. So yeah, it's the Tohoku mix of six fruits. And let me try it right now. And I can tell you straight up, this is very good.
Yeah, it looks really good.
It's obviously hard to like put a finger on which fruit it is exactly you're tasting, but it's a nice fruity mix of whatever, you know, all those six inside. And it's just a clear kind of drink.
Yeah.
No color. Highly recommended. Made by Kieran. And the second one I have is, actually I finished it while we were talking in the pre-interview, is the Hawaiian Sun Guava Nectar. So it's a guava juice straight out of Hawaii. Very nice. Delicious as well. So I'm hopped up on sugar and coffee.
With this one, yeah. So with this one, you at least know it's not Japanese right off the bat.
Yeah. And I think the importer is the same one as Apple or Grape Tizer from last week. Lead off Japan, or lead off Japan, that it says over here on the logo.
Yeah.
on the back. So maybe there is like one special company that imports a lot of these drinks.
Did you buy this at Lawson?
Yeah.
Special Lawson or whatever it is.
That yeah. Usually go. But the Grapetizer came from another supermarket. Right. Yeah. So those are my drinks for today.
So what are we talking about today?
It's a great question. That's what right. are we? I guess we're going to be jumping into a whole bunch of topics like last week. Unscripted episode 41.
So yeah. So do you want to start with the story of how your blog got copied or part of it got copied?
Yeah. So it's very ironical because we were literally talking about it, I think an episode or two episodes ago on like, we were answering one of the, how to get free images, right? And yeah. That very same day, or I think the following day, I Googled one of my articles, the one that I wanted to create some t-shirts based on the content.
Oh yeah.
And I find another article ranking above me. So I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Let me click on that. And of course, they are using my images, but they've chopped out the part of the image that contains my URL. So, and also, and it's in the same order of content in which I present my article. And I ran it through Copyscape, and like, I think 30% of the content matches textually. So they rewrote some of it, but it's still like same order, same images, and yeah, content somewhat matches. So very interesting. So like, you know, I'm like, oh Jesus, we just literally talked about it. So I mean, there's two steps you could do. You can contact Google, you can contact their hosting.
Yeah. And just to give a bit more information, I think you also found some other blog that had the exact same article, right?
Yeah. So I think they copied off of that other blog. With the other blog actually also used my content and images, but at least they left the URLs in. And this other person decided, you know, to take the extra step and crop them out. Now, I'm not saying they're like swiping images of like incredible artistic ability, far from it, but it's still weird.
Yeah, and especially just like what had happened to me before was like some websites taking entire articles and just copy pasting them onto their site.
Yeah,
I think it's some sort of script and everything, including like the internal links. So rather than pointing to some other article on their site, the internal links would actually point back to my site. And like, They would essentially just copy-paste everything, including the photos and titles.
Yeah.
I've had that happen with KN Aviation before a couple of times. And it's always, like, it always makes me kind of angry, but at the same time, whatever. But I've never seen any of those rank about me because I think Google knows that they're just, like, outright scraping content.
Yeah.
So they just ignore them. But it sounds like in your case, because they're doing some content modification and make it seem like it's their content.
Yeah.
Google decided that they're a legit site for following.
Thing is, like, it's also hard to call a copyright claim on this because, you know, all plagiarism, like, how is that saying? Or it's not a saying, but I was looking up the difference between plagiarism and copyright issues.
Yeah.
And all copyright issues are mostly issues of plagiarism, but not all issues of plagiarism are issues of copyright.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you file it, it may not exactly be you. You might not exactly have a legal case. So yeah, it's kind of hard how to approach this. I've Googled some instructions on how to deal with like people that swipe your content. Obviously, there's the DMCA takedowns. A lot of people list contacting the hosting service of the website.
Yeah.
Tell them to take it down, which I did actually. You can also contact Google with a DMCA and file a legal form with them. They'll look into it so they can no longer feature them in the results.
Yeah.
And so I did just the hosting part so far. And today I got an email. It was like, you know, it said that GoDaddy's not responsible for the content or data that people post upon their website. Please take it up with the site administrator. So
yeah, that's a very get out of jail free card type of reply from them.
Yeah. I think they would listen a little carefully if there was an actual DMCA takedown form, because once once it takes on the legal route,
yeah,
and requires more of their resources, they're gonna obviously, they don't want trouble, they'll pay attention to it a little more carefully.
Yeah.
So my options are do nothing and just like deal with it. Go to Google, submit a legal form, and also submit a DMCA takedown. Should I want to do that? Also, I guess with all of these issues, like, it's also worth asking yourself, is this worth my time and money and energy? Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. I don't know. It's like, it really depends on you and your personality and how vengeful you are.
Yeah. And I think that the problem with these things is always also the fact that none of these sites ever have any sort of contact information on their site. So it's like, you really got to go the through the back door, whether it's through the hosting or filing a DMCA claim, which I've never done before. So I don't know how easy or difficult that is.
I think there's the website dmca.com where you pay $200.
Oh, money solves everything. But yeah.
I'm not sure how they work. I guess I'll look into it. It does seem like this website, particular website, is using my content as a way to funnel users to their store.
Yeah.
Perhaps made money off of it, which perhaps might give me a legal claim to it. But again, the most important question here is how much attention and work and energy and money does this require? Sometimes it doesn't require much, or it's not worth fighting these little battles.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because it's really frustrating, that's one, because I'm sure there's a lot of hoops that you have to jump through to prove that it's your content and to get somebody to even have anything done. And then there's the other thing of like, okay, if this article, I don't know, costs you $50 and it still ranks and still makes you money, then is it really worth trying to chase down? Like, is it really worth your time? And I think that that's what I kind of try to ask more and more with all sorts of different problems.
I'm kind of in the same boat here. Also wondering, like, you know, I did send out a message to, left a comment on the blog saying so-and-so, and then I did try GoDaddy, but, you know, how much more effort is this really worth?
Yeah, I think it's really hard though, right? Because it's like, if Google's ranking them ahead of you, it means Google's taking this site seriously, which is not nice. Unlike in my case where the site was pretty clearly being ignored by Google. Just they were scraping content from the entire internet based on a couple of keywords, I guess.
And it was quite clearly 100% duplication.
And it was clearly 100% duplication. But here, I guess the other question is like, at what point does content become plagiarized? I guess if the Copyscape or whatever tool you use said 30% is kind of verbatim what you wrote, then it's pretty clear that they just copy pasted it and rewrote a thing here or there.
But
even beyond that, like if you look at a lot of the content is just a clone of another article that's rewritten slightly.
If you check the top 10 like results for a certain topic, and you get like 10 different blogs, a lot of them are just variations of each other. Probably because they all looked at each other and see what the other guy wrote, and they tried to include some of that.
Yeah, that's kind of the scary thing about SEO. Like we're doing this to an extent, but like whatever gets on top page of Google is considered to be correct.
Yeah.
Even though it might not necessarily be correct.
Yeah.
And then whoever goes there and tries to start a blog, and they look back and they're like, okay, Google ranks A, B, and C. So they go and research A, B, and C and essentially write a clone of the article. And now we have two articles that are the same on the top page.
Yeah.
And it's like confirming the truth, regardless of whether the truth is correct or not.
Yeah.
It's like creating the truth.
And at the same time, they're not really adding anything helpful or extra. It's just another variation of that article.
Yeah.
So except, I don't know, under a different domain. So at what is it really useful to the end user? Probably not. It's more so useful for the guy that ranks and then can use that traffic to earn money off of it.
Yeah.
So that's a kind of a philosophical dilemma to deal with that I also wonder about myself in terms of posting a content. And I feel like in some cases it's almost always a race to the bottom, because, you know, everyone's kind of using the same tools to figure out what content to do next. So they'll do a variation of yours. Maybe, they'll rank above yours. But again, to the end user, they type in, let's say, I don't know what's a dog? and they get like 10 blogs that are just reactive of the same thing. It's how useful is this really for the end user?
Yeah, I think I would like to believe that if you take it more as a media publishing business rather than quote unquote SEO, you kind of end up building a better resource. And again, I think it's kind of hard to distinguish on the article level, but I think when you look at the site level, then you can clearly see which site is trying to be good and which site is just trying to make money as soon as possible. So that's why I would like to think of myself as more as a content publisher than an SEO or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
Like even though to a large extent they're overlapping, but I think that the mindset behind it is slightly
different. Yeah. It just sucks though. Like when you're trying to Google something, and you have like all these articles that are clearly laid out for SEO purposes and written for SEO purposes. And like you just can't find the damn answer in there, because it's like a 3,000, 4,000 post that comes close to what you're searching for, but is not quite it.
Yeah, because like if you have an article about what is the best, I don't know, food for my dog, then you have to go for what is a dog, what types of dogs are there, and a bunch of irrelevant questions before you get to the to the answer to the question that you need.
Yeah. So they don't write content made for, you know, the actual user in mind. They're writing content for Google. I guess, so like when I write my stuff or when I edit my stuff, when it's submitted by the writers, like I always try to have like really make it easy to read, like, and like have like bullet point summaries and takeaways that can, one can actually pull out the information with what they're looking for.
Yeah.
Instead of like scrolling through the damn thing through like 500 irrelevant questions that are somewhat related to the topic at hand, but the users didn't really ask for them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it.
But yeah, that's I do wonder what the future of content marketing and search results would be like, because there's quite a lot of blogs that are, you know, trying to run the SEO game and publishing slightly different variations and slightly updated variations of what everyone else posts.
Yeah.
And kind of oversaturating search results with things that aren't really useful.
Yeah. And I guess it comes to the fact that it's just so cheap and easy to create and publish content nowadays that it's just unavoidable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of curious to see what is the next step, what will happen. But then again, also Google is very much profit oriented too. So I'm sure they'll switch up their search results in such a way that helps them as well.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about that because, like, I guess for Google, there's really no reason to rank, to always keep ranking site A over site B, because I think content is a commodity nowadays for most terms.
Yeah.
And as we were talking, like, a lot of the articles are the same. So I think Google benefits if they just keep reshuffling the results, because then nobody can benefit off of Google for free.
Yeah.
Like, what is it good for Google if it keeps the same site at the top forever? That's why I think the results are and will be volatile. Because at the end of the day, it's like everybody thinks their content is the best. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the big picture, all the content is the same to a large extent.
Yeah. I do wonder where they'll go from here.
Yeah, because I was actually reading something on, what is it, SEO Roundtable or one of those SEO news sites. And every time they post about a Google update, everybody goes like, oh, my content was so great, and yet Google put it on the second page, and now the page that's ranking number one is so bad. But it's like, chances are that it's the same, that they're the same or they're equally good.
Yeah. If you go through all the top, I don't know, the first two pages of the results, the majority of the results will be slightly different variations of each other.
Yeah, exactly. So it's going to get more and more volatile.
Something to keep in mind for the future, I guess. But I guess the same rules kind of still stick. The more links that you have pointing to you kind of makes you a more reputable source. I guess that's one thing at least you can guarantee from Google in terms of improving your rankings and domain authority.
Yeah, I think all things equal, that's true. But I also wonder to what extent all the other factors matter. Because I've seen plenty of sites with less links rank for terms where there's also sites with more links and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I wonder if even Google knows what they're doing with algorithm, or if it just gotten so complex that
no one understands.
That even they don't have an idea.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I did receive a cold email. You know, it's the usual, hey, we saw your article. We think our service belongs there. Please add it. It'll be very useful for your readers. It's like in an attempt to get a backlink. And I kind of like these articles because when I say I like them, I say it with sarcasm.
You mean the emails?
The outreach emails?
Yeah.
I say I like them with sarcasm because it's like, hey, give us a free link and we're going to do nothing for you. It's essentially how it's written. Hey, we like your post and we belong on there. And we deserve the SEO juice that we would get if you posted us up. So put us up there. And these outreach emails never really consider you. It's like, hey, how about in return, I'll give you $5 or $10. I mean, at that point, I probably consider their request a little more seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think when you follow enough SEO blogs and stuff like that, there's a couple of these strategies that they kind of promote. And I bet they all worked really well in the beginnings when nobody was doing it.
Mm.
And then now everybody's doing it and everybody just sees the email and automatically goes, all right, this is spam, essentially.
Yeah.
And I've tried it before, actually. I've tried a couple of campaigns where I send out like 100 of these and I got zero links. I've got a couple of offers to pay for a link.
Mm-hmm.
and a lot of crickets, a lot of silence.
So. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it makes sense, you know?
It's, yeah.
Essentially what it is, it's an email saying, hey, do something for free for me. Whereas you'd be probably much better off offering something of value first before you ask for, hey, let me get a free link.
Yeah.
I do wonder what they're relying for with this strategy. The person is just so wholesome and pure-hearted that they want their readers to have access to all of the resources. And so they will consider you, or they're just not aware of, like...
I think a lot of it is just people see other people saying that it works. And again, I'm sure it works at scale. Like, if you can find 500 emails with 500 relevant blogs and posts that you could get a link out of,
yeah.
Then if you email all 500 of them, then perhaps you get a link or two. Like, I'm not saying there's zero people out there that do it, but I think more and more people are aware of the strategies, and more people just... Yeah, and as for the people that actually do it, I think they just read somewhere else that it works, so they try to kind of verbatim, taking it word for word.
Yeah.
Sometimes even just copying the templates that people post out there outright, which is why there's like two or three templates that you can see in most of these emails.
Have you ever replied to any of these emails?
I think I replied to have some fun before.
Yeah, me too.
but never seriously. And it always starts nicely because you reply and they're like, oh, this guy's engaged. This guy's engaging. And then like, I think somewhere down the road at like the second or third or fourth email, they realize, oh, this guy's just making fun of us.
Yeah, and they stop replying.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a little sad. I think there was one email that I got and I replied asking like, so what are you offering in return? And they said that, we'll do a post for you on our social media. It's not exactly an equal value exchange because if I keep the link up forever, you know, it's like, it's going to be there forever, essentially. It's like Google notices that website A is pointing to website B, which means website B must be some sort of authority on this domain. Topic, since someone outside is linking to them. So, but like a social media post has very, I'm sure it has some SEO value, but not much. And it's very temporary. Any traffic comes from it in the first place. So it's not exactly an even exchange at all. I think paying me $5 to put the link up would probably be a better proposal than we'll post a Facebook post about you to our 200 fans.
Yeah, I think I had something similar. And it was on one of my posts on KN Aviation. Mm-hmm. And they're like the funniest thing about these things is that they always try to make it sound like they're trying to help your readers.
Yeah. It's always about the readers.
Yeah. And this one was like, oh, hey, I noticed you're writing about this. And I think your readers could benefit if they learned more about the Schengen zone, which is like the EU, mm-hmm. like no borders kind of zone. So we have a resource on that. And this is the link. So if you could put it there, that would be great. So I think I was telling you this story before, actually. But what I did was I put the link to Wikipedia page on the Schengen zone. And I was like, oh, hey, thanks for letting me know. I think that's a really good idea. And there might be some people that will be wondering what Schengen zone is. So I linked out to Wikipedia because I think it explains it really well.
Yeah.
And then they reply and they're like, oh, but could you put in this link? I think it's better. I'm like, no, I think the Wikipedia page is better.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, but we think this is better. I'm like, no, I think the Wikipedia page is better. And I think on like the third time they realized I'm just making fun of them probably and stop replying. But it's like again, I think like you're saying, if somebody reaches out with something where it's a fair proposition,
yeah,
then sure. But like if somebody's just following an SEO strategy that they learned about and just copy template and try to get a link, when everybody knows that they want the link.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Yeah, the fact that they try to mask it with like, hey, we're looking out for your readers. We think your readers really benefit. It's like, first of all, you're kind of dealing with me, not my readers first. So you might want to address that first, you know?
Exactly. At least if you're bothering to send me an email, at least say, hey, I'm building a new blog and I think it's going to be really cool because I have this kind of original content. Would you mind helping out by linking to it?
Yeah.
Then at least they're honest and at least you can go like, okay, sure.
Yeah.
Like, I like you as a person, so I'll do it.
You ask me like a human being.
As a favor, yeah. But like, you try to fool me saying it's good for my readers or whatever.
Yeah, it's a...
Just get out of my inbox.
Yeah. I'm going to have to reply to you just for fun.
Did you see this video? We'll have to put this in the show notes. There was this guy that replied to Nigerian scammers.
Oh, yeah.
He was like a comedian guy or something. It was really funny.
That's an area I don't want to go down in. Like... replying to scammers and phishing emails. There's actually a lot of fun YouTube videos where people take on like telemarketing scammers and, you know, like PC virus scammers. Like, I think it's more common with PCs where some elderly person will get like a pop-up saying, your computer's been infected. Please call this number. Really pop-up. not exactly a virus. And they call it, and then they have someone from overseas faking an American accent. And, you know, they have them connect remotely to their computer.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah. There's a lot of videos on that, you know. Always kind of fun to watch, especially, you know, because people know how to scam, not scam them back, but how to track them back.
Yeah.
Then they expose them on video and, you know.
Yeah, sometimes I really wonder how easy it is to get scammed if you're not aware. Or even if you're aware, if they just kind of get you into an emotional state where you're just kind of distressed, I guess.
Yeah.
Then it's like you stop thinking. Because also here, you know, there's these scams where somebody calls old people and says, hey, it's me, I'm in trouble. Can you send me, I'm your son or your daughter. Can you send me 100,000 yen to this account or scams like that? And it's like, I don't understand how people can fall for that stuff. But at the same time, I guess if like somebody calls you saying they're your son and that they're in trouble and that they need money, then perhaps you just stop thinking and just do it.
And if they remotely sound like your son, for example, then I'm pretty sure it would move a needle.
Yeah.
It might take some luck to have like someone that random luck to have someone that sounds like your son or daughter. But so that's what I imagine. Like they probably catch enough people.
Yeah.
Not a lot, but enough to make it worth it.
Yeah, the interesting thing is like that it's so prevalent in Japan that I think the ATMs every time I try to do bank transfer for the ATM, it asks me like, did somebody else call you and tell you to do this transfer? And it's like, there's this. Are you sure this is not a scam? Yes or no button that you have to press before proceeding.
Yeah, I think there was a news article maybe a month or a few weeks back about like an elderly Japanese lady trying to buy gift cards at a convenience store.
Yeah.
And there was a staff guy that noticed, picked up on it, that she was buying a whole bunch of convenience cards and asked her for the purpose of the purchase. And apparently it was like a similar computer scam, like in order to pay them.
Yeah.
So I guess the more ignorant you are of a certain subject, I guess with younger people, it's harder to fool them when it comes to computers and whatnot. Although I'm pretty sure someone can fall for a phishing email.
Yeah.
But the more ignorant you are of a subject, and we're all ignorant somewhere. We all have some blind spots somewhere. So
yeah, I think so. And right. it's easy to think of it as I don't fall for scams. It's other people fall for scams. But like until you do so, like at some point.
There was an interesting email that was making its rounds like a year or 2 years ago, and it had your password as the subject. And like if you open it up and you read it, like someone's writing, hey. As you can see, I'm emailing this from your own address. And the way it looks is, it looks like they're emailing you from the same exact address, saying that they have your password and they have like some incriminating video of you that they'll release to your friends and everyone on your Facebook contacts list. So like, that kind of, you know, email can definitely strike a chord if you saw a past password as a subject line. But the only reason that they got that password is likely because one of your account somewhere was involved in a leak or a data breach. If you've updated that password a while ago and it's not exactly an issue, they just have your old password. But it can still, I think, kind of like make someone's heart beat just a little bit faster when they see that. Like, how did you know my old password type of thing?
Yes, especially if it includes old password or stuff like that.
Yeah. So I think they probably catch enough because even if it gets an emotional, you know, response out of you, but you're still smart enough to like, not smart enough, if you're just like more careful enough to like take a look into it deeply and see if it's an actual email or if it's a fake one.
Yeah.
I think there's plenty of people that also don't catch that.
Oh yeah. I'm sure. Yeah, like, it's like if you try enough times, then you're.
I have an Amazon one also that I received like to my phone. So meaning someone has my phone number. And a text came from the number that I also like received the Amazon activation code.
Yeah.
So like the link is like a short link. And I have a personal rule. I never click on short links. And like it's a strange domain. So it's like, you know, that .xyz or something, which immediately raised red flags. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure there's a lot of people that just click on it because they don't even think about, is this a short link or what is bit.ly or stuff like that.
So yeah, the internet is a wild, wild west. On top of duplicated content and picture stealers, we also have scammers out there.
Yeah, it's decades after it's been started, and still it's still a very wild web.
Yeah,
which also, I guess, since this is the Side Hustle and Stuff podcast, we should say it also means there's a lot of opportunities.
Yeah,
not for scams, even though I'm sure there's opportunities for scams too. But for like starting blogs, starting YouTube channels, starting creating assets on the internet.
Yeah. Well, you know, that being said, going back to those YouTube channels, there's quite a bit of YouTube channels that post content specifically on tracking these scams or catching these people and educating the public or whoever just happens to be subscribed. Like, you know, CoffeeZilla is one of them in some way, but he talks more about, you know, like online gurus and entrepreneurs who are trying to sell success with their video courses. But there's other ones, you know, where you have the telemarketing scammers, they'll try to catch them, or the call center scammers, or the PC repair scammers.
Yeah.
So this, you know, so the, you know, these people started a side hustle based on this topic exactly. In terms of catching them and documenting them.
Yeah. So you can become the scam detective and help people and make money along the way.
Yeah. So that's the interesting thing. It's like someone asks you, what do you do for a living? How do you earn your money? Like, oh, I catch scams. I talk about them online. So it's like, it's one of these things that you don't really think about, but, you know, people are probably earning something off of it.
Yeah.
So what have you been up to?
Not much. I'm thinking of starting a new site sometime soon, perhaps in the next couple months.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I guess I'll have to have some goals related to that for our next episode.
Okay.
It's already the end of March.
Do you have a topic in mind?
Yeah, it's probably going to, if I go with the one that I'm starting to plan now, like I'm doing some of the initial keyword research and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
then it's going to be in the pet niche, and it's going to be focused on one type of pet. It's going to be like a niche of a niche of a niche.
Mm.
And I think compared to my other sites, like I hope to make it more of a, like I want to try a slightly different concept where instead of having a site with like 500 or 600 posts,
mm-hmm.
this is going to be a very finite site with a pretty set number of posts. I don't know if it's going to be 100 or 200, but I essentially want to try to just build it up in a couple months, post maybe, I don't know, 100 posts within those couple months, and then just post a post a week or so, just keep it active,
mm-hmm.
and see where it goes. It's like, I think essentially it will probably cost $4,000 or $5,000 if it's 100 posts.
Okay.
So it's like a little investment.
What inspired you to start this one?
I guess my initial plan was to kind of start a new site every half a year, I guess since a year and a half ago or so. But then I kind of, I had one site that I kind of resurrected, and then I had a new one and I had the biggest site. I guess I just felt like starting a new site, or I feel like starting a new site.
Okay.
And the other thing is, I just feel like, just like we were talking, the internet is still a pretty wild west sort of environment. And I feel like the more of these assets you can capture to begin with,
mm-hmm.
the more options you have. Like, again, you can either just build the site and let it sit there and make your money. Maybe you build the site to where it makes $100 and you keep it for a year or two and you grow it to like $500. And maybe then you sell it for $15,000 or
something. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's just so many options, and it's just about planting the seeds early, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
Because as both you and I know, it's not like you post content today and tomorrow it's bringing in loads and loads of traffic.
Yeah.
So it's like, if I start the site now, then by next Christmas, it might already be earning nice. Whereas if I wait, because I feel like, oh, maybe I should wait, then it's going to be only the Christmas after that that the site starts. The sooner you start, the better in this business, I think.
Yeah. I think in everything, you know, it's one of these things that's very hard to measure and track. And like, I think all answers in life is, the answer to everything, almost everything in life is the sooner you start with these things, the better.
I think on the internet, it's pretty much universal.
Yeah.
Like whether it's YouTube, whether it's Instagram and stuff like that. Or not even the internet, I guess in the content business.
Mm.
But then again, if you like want to open a laundromat or something,
yeah,
then you probably want to plan it quite well before you invest a lot of money into it.
Yeah.
And, and also, like, once you open it, then the next day you can expect customers if you're on the right street.
Well, business aside, take something like investing or, you know, putting away savings. It's like, again, like the sooner you start with some of these things, the better, or working out.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think everything that depends on kind of like regular small incremental steps that you take consistently, the sooner you start, the better, because then you have more time to take those steps and for it to compound. But yeah, like you said, whether it's saving money or hopefully investing money into whatever, the stock market or something.
Index fund. I guess like if it's a much more complicated, because again, the sooner you start, the better with a lot of things. But at the same time, some things require a bit more special thought. You can't just rush in and like unload. I don't know what, like you said, like a laundromat probably requires a bit more planning. You have to get a lot more ducks in your row.
Yeah.
And a lot of things to fill out before you, you know, you have, because what is it? I don't know what's involved, but imagine, you obviously have to buy property, you have to buy the machines, you have to pay for leases and whatnot. Pretty sure there's some sort of certificate that you got to get from the city. You have to get a lot of ducks in row.
Yeah.
As the saying goes. And it's not one of these things that maybe you can start the sooner the better, but it's like, it's not as easy as like just rolling out a blog in a weekend.
Yeah. And also the outright investment is really high, right? It's like, if you're starting a content business and you have more time than money, then you just spend the time. If you have more money than time, then you spend money. But in either case, it's even if you spend money, like starting the site that I was just talking about, it's probably going to cost, what, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000. And it's going to have the potential of making, I don't know, $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 a month consistently. So like when you look at the potential return, then the money is almost nothing.
Yeah.
And again, if I didn't have the money to invest into that, then I could just spend the time and write those articles myself and just spend my time to build an asset that pays me regularly. So I feel like the hurdle or the barrier to entry is much lower than with like physical business and starting a laundromat, finding the property,
yeah,
negotiating and signing the lease, paying probably like thousands and thousands of dollars in like rent, all sorts of real estate related fees, buying equipment, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I guess the more complicated the project, the more thought has to go into it. Any newbie, beginner, side hustler, probably the first important thing for them is to learn how to take action first. But once you've learned, you know, once you have no problem jumping into things, it's also possible to do things the wrong way from the start. Like for example, launching an ad campaign and thinking that you're going to plunge in all your money and then you lose all your money. Like some things are like definitely require a bit more careful approach.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's also like, again, even if you decide to start an ad campaign, if you start with like $200,
yeah,
then you can always switch to a different one if it doesn't work. Like, I think it's more than anything, it's the flexibility and the switching costs. Because like if you decide to start a laundromat in, I don't know, we're in Minato-ku, then by the time you actually open the laundromat, it's too late to start it in Ikebukuro or in some other part of the city. Because you have to close down the shop, you have to still pay the rent, you have to move all the equipment elsewhere and stuff like that. Whereas with like blog, YouTube channel, Instagram, and all these different things, it's like, you don't like the photo you posted this week, or you don't like the post that you posted this week, then post a different one next week, try a different style, whatever. And there's no cost associated with that.
But in the sense of an ad campaign, it is no one with a lot of experience, you know, let's say you have $200, right?
Yeah.
And that's all you have, literally. No experienced person will put everything that they have into one campaign and try it out. It's like all projects start small and they get scaled up because like first you have to prove viability. But that's not, I think, what the beginners are aware of. The beginners like rush all in and try to shut, you know, obviously you'll be like, all right, if I only have $200, can I afford to do this? If I can't, I won't. But like, I still don't think it's a built-in kind of wisdom that beginners have or know of. I think that's something that comes with practice, because there's been times that, you know, in my own work where we do a project and then, you know, like the first thing is you do it on a small scale and then you scale it up. But there were times, you know, back in my beginner days where I would just scale up without actually checking if anything was wrong or if anything went down. Cause like there's always all kinds of unforeseen problems that could happen with one thing or the next thing. And if you're not checking to make sure that everything's still working and you scale it, suddenly you have a really large scaled problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's just about not putting all your eggs in the same basket. It's like if you're starting a site and I don't know, perhaps on one of your site, some concept worked really well. So you decide to try it out and just start a site just around that concept.
Yeah.
I think that's good if you already have a successful site that's making you money to fund all of this, because you probably don't want to be spending too much of your own money on this experiment. And two, if you have pretty good gut feeling about what works and what doesn't, just because you've been doing it for years and you kind of can figure it out without even knowing how you're figuring it out. But if you're just getting started out, then I think it's really, and it can be difficult because it's like you can get too scattered, because if you get too scattered, then you get nothing, because nothing catches on.
Yeah.
But then again, if you also get too focused on one thing, if that one thing that you're focusing on is wrong, then you're essentially driving yourself into the ground.
Yeah.
So it can be difficult. But again, I think in these regards, like content businesses are are forgiving versus ad-based businesses and stuff like that are.
Anything that requires upfront investment, like if you're selling physical products also.
Yeah. And that's why I think it's, I admire people that are willing to take like, I don't know, 20, 30, 50, 100, 200, 500,000 of their money embedded into starting a company, which is kind of the traditional way of doing business, right? It's like you get a $200,000 loan and you open a store or something.
Yeah.
And to me, that just sounds so risky. And like, I could never do it. I don't think I'm pretty risk averse. And I prefer to kind of scale things up gradually.
Yeah.
But again, if somebody's so convinced about this one idea and are willing to put in a lot of money, I really admire that as well. And I think that's, in a way, that's, I guess, what people imagine under entrepreneurship.
Mm.
I'm not sure I would call it quote unquote true entrepreneurship, but it certainly is kind of the original concept of this.
I think you're only impressed and you only envy it when they strike it big. But just as, you know, similarly, the opposite can happen.
Not even then. Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's about the outcome. I think it's about having the guts to just say, all right, I have $200,000 in my account. I'm going to take those $200,000 and I'm going to rent a cafe on Fifth Avenue or something.
Okay.
Although you probably need more than that to open a Fifth Avenue from what I hear. But it's just that. It's like you decide to take money and part your ways with it essentially for the foreseeable future, believing that you get it back with dividends at one point, which I think is the traditional model of entrepreneurship. Whereas now you can just take your time, of which you have plenty if you're young and you're like university student or something.
Yeah.
And you can kind of gradually build up rather than having to work hard for your money and then risk all that money.
Mm.
Now you can work hard for the asset directly.
Yeah. This is a book that I finished reading not too long ago, My Life in Advertising by Claude Hopkins.
Yeah.
Claude Hopkins was one of the original ad men back in the day. He also wrote Scientific Advertising. And basically this book consists of like a lot of the accounts or projects that he took on. And for example, I'm looking at the chapter for Palmolive was a product that he took on. I think
is that the soap brand or something?
Yeah. And I think he was turning it down at one point or another. But so it was Palmolive and not just Palmolive, like a lot of the accounts were like the new stuff that they would take on, the new products, they would always start small. They would start an experiment, for example, in one city. In the case of Palmolive, and I quote from the book, we suggested a trial in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We estimated that it could be made for about $1,000, but that was too much money to stake on so uncertain a venture. So we were forced to compromise on Benton Harbor, Michigan, where the cost was about $700. In that little city appeared the first ads on Palmolive soap. And let me see what the results was. And basically the next few paragraphs are like the outlines of their plan and how they're going to just give it away.
Yeah.
So, and then follow up is, such was the plan that we used in Benton Harbor on the initial Palmolive ads. The cost, including the redemption of coupons, was $700. As a result, several thousand women were started on this soap with the full knowledge of its qualities and purpose. Then we waited to see the full effect. What will users do when they try the soap? The answer to that question is the most vital factor in advertising. So now I come to some figures, which may not be exact. This campaign was started in 1911. My memory may be somewhat, but not seriously at fault. The repeat sales in Benton Harbor paid for the advertising before the bills were due. We knew then that we had struck a responsive chord. We knew that we had a winner. We tried the same test ads in numerous cities and always with similar results. So like, but that's how they, you know, that's smart advertising. You don't go in like full blast parading your product on national networks across all. You start some, like back then they would start, well, I'm pretty sure they still do it now. You start in a small city and then if it works, then you scale up.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's an interesting point because I think when it comes to ads, like the ads that people remember, like, what was it, the Apple ad or the IBM ad a while back? I think that's kind of an iconic one. And
the 1984 ad?
Oh, yeah, that one.
Yeah, that was the Apple ad.
Oh, yeah, that was an ad. And the Super Bowl ads and stuff like that, people remember those because they're quote-unquote legendary.
Mm-hmm.
But then I bet that the biggest money makers are exactly like you were talking about, Palmolive, is these ads that kind of get scaled up from a really small thing and get rolled out across the country and across the world gradually, because obviously they get rolled out more and more because they work really well.
Yeah.
And like
maybe a lot of people don't know about the campaigns, but they're probably the biggest cash cows, would be my guess, compared to like the really notorious like Super Bowl ads and stuff like that.
I think those Super Bowl ads are mostly, I don't know, for branding, or everyone's kind of trying to compete to see which ad is the most talked about.
Yeah.
But in marketing, there's that line of thinking is like, if a person notices the ad for the ad, then, you know, the ad's dead in the water.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but if they see the ad and they consume it and they enjoy the content or whatever message that the ad is sending, it'll probably strike a better chord and probably result in more sales and better branding. But if you like remember like, oh, hey, by the way, that so-and-so company's ad was so clever, I laughed, LOL, ha, ha, ha. That won't result any dollars for them. It's just like a clever ad. In I guess in my space of copywriting, clever ad is never a good ad because it means that the person noticed the words that you're using.
Yeah.
And that's the last thing you want. You don't want them to notice like what words you're using. You want them to read your message and get influenced by the message rather than saying, oh, what you wrote is so clever.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting thing, actually. In kind of a broader scale, is like, what metrics do you focus on?
Yeah.
And like people like to focus on vanity metrics because it looks nice and it's like, oh, we got however many, I don't know, Facebook subscribers, or oh, we've got however many inquiries, or but it's like at the end of the day, what matters is the bottom line, and unless all of those convert, then they're just dead weight, right?
Yeah, and it's like an expense,
yeah, especially in case of a Super Bowl ad.
But I can't speak much on branding advertising because I've not really looked into that. I'm pretty sure there is argument in favor of branding, but I do wonder about the Super Bowl ads themselves, because people tune into the Super Bowl ads knowing exactly that they're going to be watching ads. They're going to be like on the lookout which ad is the most interesting one.
Yeah.
So I do wonder how well those work, if at all. But I also know, I feel like ads that like similar, I don't know, just guessing here, like someone, whoever is listening, feel free to correct me here. I wonder, you know, if it's not the Super Bowl and you're watching TV and a branding ad comes on, I'm wondering that it'll probably have a stronger effect, because like you're not really there to expect an ad. You're just like kind of like passively watching and absorbing it.
Yeah.
Rather than be like, oh, hey, there's that ad that we were looking for the Super Bowl. Let's watch the ad.
Yeah. Actually, I think the most important part of an ad is the music. Like, I feel like music is what people remember and associate with.
What ads are your favorites?
I don't know, actually. I don't even remember what ads I've recently seen, because I kind of tune out of them. But like, I know there's, for example, in Japan, there's quite a few songs that have become popular because of ads.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure whether it's something like we're talking about the vanity metrics. It's like people know the songs, but they have no idea that the song was in the ad.
Mm.
Or whether people actually associate the song with ad. But I feel like if you get the song right and the message right, then the chances of building some sort of brand trust or whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm,
are definitely higher than if it's just like a spoken word sort of ad.
I'm sure there's a reason for it. They probably tested it.
Yeah, because I guess sound is really important, right? It's like even in videos, if the video is kind of sketchy quality but the sound is okay, then it's easy to watch. But if the video is like 4K quality but the sound is complete, is crap allowed on this podcast?
I'm sure it is. Right. We can ask the owners.
All right, but if the audio is complete crap, then you kind of tune out and stop paying attention.
Yeah, I think I have to double check my book Ogilvy on Advertising. I think he had some things to say about jingles, but I can't think of it at this point. But I do recommend the My Life in Advertising.
Yeah, I've read about the book before, and I wanted to put it on my to read list. I'm really behind on my. I'll have to get to. But yeah, listening to the story about Palmolive that you just told, it sounds like something I would really enjoy. If it includes a lot of case studies like that. So.
Yeah, it's like, well, yeah, I think the first two chapters are like his life and early life and like start in business, and the rest of the book. It's not a long book. This one is 203 pages or so.
Nice.
212, I think. Yeah, but the rest of it is just like, you know, his work in this ad agency, then his experience with selling cars, his experience with selling Palmolive, his experience with selling Liquizone. So, and there's a lot of really interesting stories there, and like a lot of kind of insights to take away. Here you go. For example, in this chapter, he is selling, well, this is on personal salesmanship, but it's on, I think, selling medicine or medical advertising. And he says, night after night, Dr. Shoup and I discussed the situation. I told him all I had done by talking ideas not connected with the product. Then we evolved the idea of a druggist's signed guarantee. People were not buying medicine. They were buying results. Many an advertiser 1,000 miles away offered to guarantee results, but the guarantors were strangers. I conceived the idea of having a neighborhood druggist to whom people paid their money, sign the guarantee. So it's like, you know, I guess back in the day in small town USA,
yeah,
you know your local pharmacist. And if your local pharmacist signs the advertisement saying, you know, for so-and-so drug, I guarantee results or your money back. Now you don't have like a random stranger doctor, like 9 in 10 doctors approve of this message. You have your actual neighborhood guy.
Yeah.
And so this is one example. And late, he said, first, I tried this plan out on a cough cure. It brought in enormous results. Here was one cough cure which anyone could buy without risk. If it brought results, we promised, it was worth many times its cost. If it failed, it was free. No cough cure on the market then could compete with that. I think that's a typo. Later, I tested the same plan on other remedies, on Dr. Shoup's restorative, on his rheumatic care. It worked like magic. Others made claims, but we offered certainty. And we secured most of the trade. So there's a lot of little insights in that. A lot of things worth underlining. So I highly recommend this book. And I think I will definitely go do a round two with it. The other book, like just... if you're interested in this, I also recommend the Robert Collier letter book. It's also very, very old, first published in 1931. And I think he was a direct response writer or advertiser.
Yeah.
And he went into all kinds of, into selling all kinds of products. And like each chapter, I guess, was kind of focused on what kind of campaign they did and what, how they did it and how they sold it and what kind of appeals they used.
Yeah.
Very historic stuff, but also very interesting to read. Because I don't think you nowadays you can find many books, you know, like of someone revealing, first we tried this product, then we adjusted that, then we did this, then we did that. Because probably all the marketers are going to hop on that, like, not the hyenas. Which, you know, what are those birds that fly around in Africa?
Condors?
Yeah, the I think they're condors.
I think so.
I feel like there's another word for them. Maybe they are condors. Yeah.
I know what they're called in Slovak. Hold on.
Vulture.
Oh, yeah, vulture.
Like, because marketers would be, you know, circling around those books like vultures and looking for trade secrets and whatnot. So I don't think many companies are really inspired to publish, you know, what they did with so-and-so.
Yeah, I also wonder how he dealt with, I guess maybe back when he was doing business, there weren't many NDAs and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't think you could disclose that sort of.
Yeah. Yeah, because you do sign, like, probably, you probably do sign something with your, even if you're a freelance copywriter.
Oh, yeah, the non-disclosure. So maybe they expired or maybe they just didn't do that back then. The world was a nicer place overall.
Yeah. Well, I do, if you're interested, the book is called The Robert Collier Letter Book. And it's pretty thick, too.
Cool. Yeah, we should link to both of those. I'll definitely start with the My Life in Advertising.
Nice. All right. This has been episode 41 of the Side Hustles and Stuff podcast with Kay Sheenier. If you want to do check out the books that we talked about today, My Life in Advertising by Claude Hopkins and the Robert Collier Letter Book by Robert Collier. Check out the show notes, sidehustlesandstuff.com/E41. And if you do want to start your own side hustle, if you want to buy a website, check out Bluehost in the show notes where you can buy .com and launch your work out into the world. So visit the show notes, sidehustlesandstuff.com/E41. And don't swipe images off the internet.
Yeah, and don't fall for scams.
Yeah, and don't click on short links. And this has been the Side Hustles and Stuff podcast with Kay Sheenier.
Talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week. You know, I didn't want to leave you hanging, but I have to admit there were no bloopers in this episode. For some reason, we made a lot less mistakes than usual, which is probably not the best thing for the blooper part of the episode. So I don't want to leave you hanging. I'm recording something here, so you can consider this as a blooper. Talk to you next time.